I think you may all have noticed there's some construction going on here.
Yes?
This was one of the dearmost projects that Srila Prabhupada emphasized. It was one of his most intimate offerings of his life to our Guru Parampara. To build such a beautiful temple that people throughout the entire world would come to associate with devotees, participate in Nam Sankirtan, hear Hari Katha, take Krishna's prasad, and be purified by the unlimited grace that is emanating from this holy place of Mayapur. The place of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, the Panchatattvas, eternal pastimes. The place where the greatest of our acharyas or spiritual preceptors came to perform their own devotion. The birthplace of the Sankirtan movement. Today, Kirtan is becoming very famous all over the world. According to our scriptures and our histories, Navadvip is the birthplace of Kirtan. Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtan. The prime benediction for all humanity. Kalerdo sanidera janasti heku mahan guna kirtana deva krishnasya mukta sanga param prajet. The age of Kali is an ocean of faults. But compared to this ocean of Kali, the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, they are like little puddles. This is a fathomless, vast, endless ocean of crippling influences. But there's one benediction in the age of Kali that simply performing Sankirtan, chanting the holy names of the Lord, one can attain the perfection of liberation. Not just liberation. In common terms, liberation means to be free from the dualities of material existence, which bind us to attachment to those things that are temporary. Liberation frees us from suffering, frees us from birth, old age, disease, and death. But that's just a preliminary state of transcendental consciousness. Haridas Thakur explained that the ultimate goal, the real true perfection of liberation, which can be revealed from within our heart, when we chant Krishna's holy names, and Krishna has many names, is prema, the awakening of the ecstatic love, love for Krishna, love for Sri Radha, love for all living beings who are the children of Radha and Krishna. That love is ever increasing and is forever. It is our intrinsic, inherent nature. Anandam buddhivaratanam pratipadam punamrita svadhanam. It is the happiness that everyone is seeking. That is the benediction of kirtan. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as we have cited from Rupa Goswami, Namo Mahabhadanyaya Krishna Prema Padayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namane Gaudatveshe Namaha. There are many avatars, many incarnations of the Lord who have come throughout the world, throughout history, in different times and places, to reestablish Dharma, Sanatana Dharma, true spiritual principles, to remind us of what we have forgotten, that we are all eternal souls, part of God, and that this world is the perfect place to cultivate that God consciousness. If we have proper vision, proper guidance, and proper motivation. But of all the great incarnations, Lord Chaitanya is considered to be the most magnanimous. Now, this is something of a contradiction. But spiritual knowledge is full of perfectly harmonious contradictions, wherein there is no contradiction. One time, a great scholar of Vedas in the Western world said to Srila Prabhupada, among the acharyas, the saintly teachers, there are so many contradictions. And Prabhupada said, there are no contradictions. But there appear to be. So if there's one God, how could one God be more magnanimous than himself? Because all the avatars are Krishna. Kurma, Varaha, Narasingha, Vamana, Ram, Balaram. They are all Krishna. So how is he more magnanimous than himself? Because as Lord Chaitanya, he's coming in the role of his own devotee to teach us by his own example how to love Krishna. And he's giving the most intimate level of love of God freely, something that is so rare to the most exalted Paramhamsas. The love of the gopis of Vrindavan, he has brought in the age of Kali. And what is the price? A humble and grateful heart of chanting the holy names of the Lord with good character and a true desire to serve. That's all. Anyone can do it. Therefore, the Bhagavad tells us that the greatest sages and rishis worship and honor Kali Yuga as the best of all times. It's the time of the most suffering, the most hypocrisy, the most quarreling and fighting, but the greatest benediction is given in all of that. And that benediction advented especially here in Sri Mayapur Dham. Prabhupada was thinking of this temple when he didn't even have any money. But he understood it was the will of the previous acharyas. Long, long ago, the greatest avatars and incarnations were talking about an Adbhut Mandir, a glorious temple that would attract the world. And today we have a presentation on Srila Prabhupada's disappearance. Today there's going to be an elaborate presentation. Today just a small presentation of how each and every one of us can be a part of it. But to really be a part of it means to put your love and devotion into it. And to put your love and devotion into it means some sacrifice. Because you see, Srila Prabhupada considered this so important, so divine, that he wanted to give a chance to everyone to participate. In Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, we read about King Prataparudra. He was the king of the whole state of Orissa. And he utilized his entire treasury and all of his powers and all of his influences to serve Lord Chaitanya. And then we read about Suklambar Brahmachari, who was just a little Brahmachari who lived in a little straw hut just on the bank of the Ganga a few minutes away from here. And he had nothing. He was a true Brahmachari, according to the classical sense. He didn't even have a cell phone. Can you imagine a Brahmachari so renounced? He would go out to beg, and he would go to about 10 or 11 houses to beg, minimum. He didn't want to take too much from any house. And he was constantly chanting the holy names of the Lord. He was wearing little raggedy clothes. And then with whatever rice he would collect, and it was usually the... Most people don't give beggars the best things in their house. Most people give beggars a hard time. They just ignore them. Get out from here. Or maybe just to get rid of them. Or with some pious sentiment. You just give the worst thing, something. Take this. People usually take the broken, old, dirty kind of pieces of rice to give to beggars. And once, at the house of Srivas, when Lord Gauranga was performing his kirtan, he sat on the altar. One of those rare, precious moments where he was actually fulfilling his devotees' desires, where they could make offerings to him. Otherwise, he was always making offerings to them. And as the kirtan was going and all these incredible, exalted personalities were singing and dancing, Lord Chaitanya saw little Suklambar somewhere in the back of the kirtan. And he was just blissfully chanting Krishna's names. He had no money. He had no prestige. Besides Lord Chaitanya, nobody even knew he was an advanced devotee. Everyone just thought he was an ordinary beggar. But when he took all that rice, took it home, he cooked it in a little pot. He offered it to Krishna. He would be in such transcendental happiness. And here he was tasting the sweetness of the holy name, his heart bursting with bliss, dancing. You see, in the kirtan of real bhakti, dancing is not some sort of step like the dances in this world. every movement of every limb is an expression of our gratitude and our love for Krishna, who has appeared in his name. We're actually immersing, absorbing our body, our mind, our words, our very life as an offering of surrender, devotion, and love to Krishna as we're chanting. And as he was dancing, he had this cloth bag, an old tattered bag that he would beg with. It was on his shoulder, and it was swinging back and forth and in all directions as he was dancing. And Lord Chaitanya looked at him and smiled. It was such a sight. He was just so simple, so innocent, dancing like a child with his little bag flying around. Lord Chaitanya called him. Suklambar came forward, and Lord Chaitanya, he said, "Birth after birth, you are my beggar devotee. And I am hungry for whatever you beg." And everyone in the room was, "What is he talking?" Then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he had long arms. They extended below his knees. If he wanted to take something from you or give something to you, nothing could come between his will. So he thrust his beautiful golden hand into the bag and came out with a handful of broken pieces of the cheapest quality rice. It wasn't even cooked. It was just what people threw in the bag. It wasn't even cleaned. They just threw it in. And Lord Chaitanya ate it. Suklambar was, "How could you eat this, my lord? It is not fit for you." And all the devotees were shocked. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there were tears streaming from his big, beautiful, lotus-like eyes, reddened with affection. He said, "I have never tasted anything so sweet as the rice of Suklambar." Then he thrust his hand in again and ate handful after handful. So whether, like King Pratapa-Rudra, we offer palaces and treasuries, or whether we're like Suklambar Brahmachari and we offer some broken pieces of rice, it is our devotion that the Lord accepts. And it is that devotion that gives quality to whatever is offered. In this temple, Srila Prabhupada's will, that people who have much could help with much as an offering of love, not because of pressure, not because of having your name written forever, out of love. Whether it's a paisa, or whether it's a crore, or whether it's, you know, through our intelligence, through our abilities. Srila Prabhupada wanted all devotees from all around to be united in this great opportunity to expand Lord Chaitanya's mercy and the Sankirtan movement throughout the world. In this story we told about Suklambar Brahmachari, one interesting truth in that is that he never even offered the rice. The Lord stole it. Because Krishna is so hungry for the love of his devotee. We all have heard the story of when Krishna was in Hastinapur. Duryodhana invited him to be his special guest of honor. In a magnificent palace, he had arranged a feast from the finest master cooks that would be served on gold and silver bejeweled plates. He had gifts of ornaments, of the precious most materials. He had entertainment planned of musicians and dancers, the best of the world. Krishna walked right by his house because Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridesha Arjuna Tishtati. Krishna's in everyone's heart. He doesn't see what we offer it. He sees the purpose in which it is offered. He is Bhava Grahi Janardana. He accepts the quality of our love. He doesn't need anything else. The Lord is Lakshminath, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. He's the proprietor of everything that exists. He's the husband of the goddess of fortune. What does he need? But he's hungry for the love of each and every one of us. That is how God is great. The fact that the one supreme truth can create unlimited universes, can be the father of all living beings, is the source of everything that exists, is great. But what's even greater than that, is that although he is Parameshwara, Parabrahman, he's hungry for the love of each and every spirit souls. Little you and me and everyone else. When we awaken that selfless spirit of love in our heart, Krishna's hungry to taste it. How great is that? He's so hungry that where there's love, he may not even wait for it to be offered. He comes and steals it. Krishna is Makkan Chor. That means he's a butter thief. In Vrindavan, when Krishna was a little boy, especially during this month of Damodar, he would steal butter, yogurt from gopis. And they would complain to Yashodamai, his mother. The reason they would complain to Yashodamai was simple, because then they get to talk about Krishna. And they just, there's no more blissful taste to the heart than talking about Krishna and remembering Krishna in such special ways. And they were talking about him by apparently finding faults with him. But it was love. Yashodamai said, all right, I'll somehow keep him home. They said, no, please don't do that. The only reason we make our butter is with the hope and the prayer that Krishna will come and steal it. When our hearts become soft and sweet like that butter, Krishna will steal our hearts. Bhakti is the process of churning our hearts and removing all the impure things so that it's very soft and very sweet. So Suklambar Brahmachari, he didn't have a bell where he was ringing it and chanting mantra, tantra, yantra, mudra, puja. He didn't do any of that. But the Lord took his rice.
because he was eager to taste Suklambar's devotion.
So when Krishna was walking by from Duryodhana, he understood Duryodhana's heart. Duryodhana wanted to please the Lord, to get the Lord on his side, so that he could execute his envious plans toward the Pandavas. So Krishna didn't care about all the jewels and all the silk and all the fine foods. He just walked right by. But he was hungry. He was hungry for devotion. So he went to Vidura's house. Vidura, he was disqualified from any royalty because of certain technical situations in his life. He lived in a little simple house. And according to the how many tell the story, he wasn't even home. His wife was home. When Krishna came, he knocked. He was unannounced. Can you imagine? You hear a knock on the door, you open it, and it's Krishna. And he said, "I'm hungry. I was supposed to go to Duryodhana's house, but I didn't want to eat at his house. I'm hungry." And she didn't have any food in the house. All she saw in the whole house was one banana. And she was so nervous, she peeled the banana, threw the banana out, and gave Krishna the peel. Krishna ate it and enjoyed it profusely. He would rather eat a banana peel from the hands of a loving servant than even royal cuisine from someone who has ulterior motives. So that is bhakti. That is Krishna's greatness. And Krishna descended into this world in this age of Kali Yuga as Lord Chaitanya, especially to enlighten us with what he called the Purushatta Siromani, the crest jewels of all goals of life, the Prem Nidhi, the ultimate wealth of love. I'd like for a few minutes to briefly share the story of how Lord Chaitanya descended into this world. We read that there were three external reasons and three internal reasons why Krishna appeared in his original transcendental form. Most avatars are expansions or expansions of the one Lord. You see, the Lord is one, but reveals different quantities and qualities of his infinite, unlimited compassion according to the time, place, and circumstance. This concept of achintya bheda bheda tattva, inconceivable oneness and difference, it's an all-encompassing philosophical principle. Every living being, the living force within all of our hearts, that living force that's me and you, who sees through the eyes and tastes through the tongue and hears through the ears and smells through the nose and touches through the flesh and thinks through the brain and loves through the heart, that living force, when it leaves this body, the body is like an automobile without a driver. It has no capacity to function. That Atma is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And what is the quality? Krishna tells in Gita, Mamayavam so jivaloke jiva bhuta sanatana. Every living being, this jiva, this spiritual force,
is part and parcel of Krishna.
Like a sun ray to the sun, qualitatively gives heat and light like the sun. But quantitatively, the sun ray is always just a part of the sun. It's never the sun.
And the sun ray is always coming from the sun. The sun never comes from the sun ray.
So it's simultaneously one and different. That is our relationship with the Lord.
We are one in quality.
And in the bhakti tradition, the highest oneness is realized when our hearts, through love, merge eternally, infinitely with Krishna's will.
When we taste Krishna's infinite love and Krishna tastes our love.
But still, for the purpose of ras, for the purpose of relationship, we remain individuals.
And similarly, material nature is one with God and different from God.
Because the shakti, the energy of the Lord, is coming from the Lord. Om Purnam Adapurnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachit.
The Ishopanishad tells
that the absolute truth is perfect, complete, and everything emanating from the absolute truth is perfect and complete.
And Krishna tells in Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhova Mata, Aham Sarvasya Prabhova,
that all spiritual and material worlds are emanating from me,
the source of everything.
So this material world is God
as his energy. But at the same time, it's not God, because it's his external energy.
But the energy and the energetic are coming from the same source.
And similarly, God himself is a Chintaveda Veda Tattva.
He appears as Varaha. He appears as Narasingha. He appears as Kurma. He appears in countless incarnations as Lord Ramchandra, the son of Dasarath. He appears in his original form once every 4,320,000,000 years as Krishna, the son of Nanda and Yashoda, and reveals his Vrindavan pastimes.
Now, how is this one indifferent?
Let's just think about it from a practical way, because sometimes philosophy could best be understood by practical meditations.
The cowherd boys are wrestling with Krishna.
Yes?
And they're defeating Krishna. Nobody can defeat Krishna.
But because their love for Krishna as playful friends is so much, they want to please Krishna so much, and they know that Krishna will be pleased if they defeat them, if they defeat him. So they're trying to win just to make him happy. And Krishna loses just to make their happy. That's their love.
That's Vrindavan. Now let's just go back a yuga to Ramchandra. Hanuman was a great devotee.
Did you ever hear any story of Hanuman wrestling with Ram?
That's a Chintaveda Veda Tattva. Same Lord.
Did you ever hear of Bharat? Did you ever hear of Ram stealing butter? And then saying he didn't steal it?
When Krishna, after when he was stealing butter, he was feeding it to the monkeys. He was telling them, in my past incarnation, you were the monkeys who helped me to get Sita back. And I was living in the forest and I had nothing to give you. So now come, I will give you butter.
And Narasingha Dev, when he was roaring
and all the demigods were afraid to come near him. Even Lakshmi, Brahma said, you know, Lakshmi, you go and pacify. He's your husband. Lakshmi looked at him and said, I just don't know him like this.
It was little Prahlad who came forward. And as Krishna, the gopis are chastising him, Mother Yashoda is with a stick. Can you imagine? Mother Yashoda with a stick to Narasimhadev? Same person. So this is a Chintaveda Vedata. The Lord is inconceivably simultaneously one and different than himself.
And this is his greatness.
So the three external reasons why Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appears in this world are revealed by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami. One is to fulfill his promise in Bhagavad Gita. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham.
That again and again and again in this world, when there is a rise in irreligion and a decrease in
religion, in true, genuine spiritual principles, I descend into this world.
Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chatuskritam dharma samstapanaradaya sambhavami yuge yuge.
Krishna comes to reestablish the truth.
Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, what is the truth?
To understand that all living beings are in me, are of me, and are mine. To reveal to people that we are strangers in a foreign land, for the eternal soul to try to be happy with the cheap thrills of the temporary pleasures of this material existence is really an embarrassment.
But sometimes when a person is so intoxicating, they put themselves to do things that are so embarrassing and humiliating, and they don't even know that they're doing it.
That's the deluding potency of Maya. All we have to do to get out of it is choose to do so.
And Krishna descends to show us the way. Sanatan Dharma are eternal religious principles. And the Lord also came to establish the Yuga Dharma.
In every age, there is a very effective, simple, powerful way by which we could realize our love for Krishna.
In the age of Kali Yuga, it is Hari Kirtan, the chanting of the names of the Lord. And the third reason, which we're going to be discussing, is his loving devotee, who was the reservoir of profound compassion for every living being.
Advaitacharya.
He prayed and cried for Krishna to come to shower his love upon us. And the three internal reasons. Sri Radha is the Haladini Shakti, the pleasure potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
She is the Ashraya Vigraha, the abode of all love, all devotion, all grace.
And Krishna is the object of all love.
Love, because Radha and Krishna are one, the one supreme truth in two forms for the sake of exchanging the deepest pleasure of spiritual love. and they expand themselves into unlimited jivas like us, just to participate in their love. This is the beauty of the spiritual world. It's not just only a void. It's not just only a vibrant, impersonal energy. That's there. But beyond that, there's dynamic relationships of the most intimate ecstasies of love between God Himself and all of us who are parts and parcels. We are all created only for that purpose. But for love to have depth, feeling, and satisfaction, it's most perfect when it is by our free will. And all love is ultimately emanating from Sri Radha. Krishna was feeling that the pleasure she is experiencing in tasting my love is something even I can't understand. I'm the giver of love, but I want to taste what the receiver of my love is feeling. Because she's happier than me even. And I'm supremely happy. This is inconceivable. Krishna's supremely happy. He's ever increasingly happy. But Radha is even more happy. How could something that's unlimited, absolutely full and complete, have something more? That's what God is about. Inconceivable dynamic of pleasure, of love. What is the nature of Radha's love? What is it about him that awakens so much love in her? And what does she taste when she feels his love?
Radha bhava duti suvalitam nomi Krishna swarupam.
Krishna descends into this world with the mahabhav, with the love of Sri Radha.
And it is explained by an acharya that in Goloka Vrindavan, when Krishna told Sri Radha that I'm going to descend to taste the sweetness of your love,
we are two, but we will become one.
And Srimati Radharani said, if you descend into this world with my love in your heart, then when you chant my names, you're going to roll in the ground in ecstasy. And I can't bear seeing that. So I will cover your body with my complexion. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna with Radharani's complexion and her devotion.
And he especially, for this purpose, he combines it with the Yuga Avatar, which is establishing the process of self-realization for this age, but like no other Yuga Avatar. Because through the Lord Chaitanya is not just giving liberation and love of God in Vaikuntha, the way most Yuga Avatars give. He is giving the love of Radha, the love of the gopis, the love of Vrindavan through Harinam Sankirtan.
Thus, Rupa Goswami says, he is most magnanimous.
And he takes such a humble position in the role of his own devotee to teach by his own example.
When the Lord descends into this world, he doesn't come alone. He sends intimate associates from the spiritual world before him and with him. The story of Ram Lila, Dasarat Kausalya
They are the eternal parents of Ram from Vaikuntha. They descend before him to facilitate and to reveal the love between them to this whole world and invite the world to enjoy it. Yashoda, Nanda, Balaram, the principal gopas and gopis, they descend from Goloka. And many purified souls from this material world, the sadhana siddhas, they rise up to perfect their devotion by associating with these nitya siddhas from the spiritual world. So Lord Chaitanya, first he sent many of his most precious loving devotees. Many of them were born here in Navadweep. Others were born in different places. Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Mukunda Dat, Vasudev Dat, they appeared before the Lord in Chittagong. Haridas Thakur near Bainapol. Rup Sanatan Goswami, they were going to be taken near Jessore. Nityananda Prabhu in Ekachakra. Paramananda Puri in Trihuta. And quite a few devotees appeared in the Selat area, then known as Trihuta. Advaitacharya, Navagram. There was one very great devotee. His name was Upendra Mishra. He had seven sons. One of those sons was named Jagannath Mishra. Upendra Mishra was a great, great devotee. His father was Madhukar Mishra, who came from the western provinces of India, and later settled in Bangladesh and gave birth to his children. He was a very, very powerful Vaishnav. Jagannath Mishra came to Navadweep for his studies. Nilambar Chakravarti was also from that Silet area. He was living in Navadweep. He was a great scholar. And he had a daughter named Sachi. Most beautiful, pure-hearted, loving person. And when Nilambar Chakravarti saw the qualities of Jagannath Mishra, in his heart he knew that they should be married. They were none other than Nanda and Yashoda from Braj Bhumi. And they settled and had a little house not far from here on the bank of the Ganga in Mayapur. What was Navadweep like at that time? Our scriptures and our biographers, they tell Navadweep was the highest seat of learning in all of India. And from a scriptural perspective, in all the world. This is about 500 years ago. Scholars from every part of India were coming here to learn and to teach. Where we are sitting now, it was an incredible empire of knowledge. It was like a city. There were millions of people coming here, but everyone came for knowledge.
In Navadweep, you
had no prestige unless you were a learned scholar. Having money, anybody could do that. No prestige in having money. Having power and fame, so what? Being a prime minister, a king, go to your castle and waste your time. Having, all kinds of beautiful families and everything else. Yes, we want to enjoy it, but there's nothing special about that. knowledge, scholarship, erudition, that is greatness. That was the standard that everyone in this town, every parent did everything they could for their children to be great scholars. And when it comes to marrying their daughters, scholar, pundit. My daughter will marry a pundit that will defeat all other pundits.
And everyone carried around books. And when you carried a book, you had to defend what was in the book, because everyone was always challenging each other.
If you didn't know your book, then you would be made into a complete fool. So different levels of books, according to the book that you were carrying, you had certain prestige. And somebody would see your book, and they would be holding the same book, and there would be a battle of intellect to see who knew best from that book. And if somebody was holding a higher topic, you would kind of hide and do more study. This is Navadvip.
There are six systems of philosophy according to the Vedic tradition.
What are they? They are the Sankhya philosophy, the Vaisheshika philosophy, the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, the Nyaya philosophy, Vedanta philosophy. What was the other? Yoga philosophy.
And one who had mastered all these six theses was considered great, great scholar. Now here in Navadvip, five of the six had the most powerful, learned professors all over the place. But the Nyaya philosophy,
they didn't have an authoritative school here in Navadvip. And this was the one defect. They had everything. The most powerful scholars were people from all over the world could study, but not Nyaya. The reason is you had to have the book to teach from. And there was only one place in planet Earth that had the book of Nyaya philosophy. And that was in Mithila.
Very sacred place.
Mithila is where, very close by, Sita was born to King Janak.
Mithila is the place where Ram came with Lakshman and Vishwamitra Muni and
saw the bow of Shiva.
That Ravana and the greatest kings and the princes could not even pick up from its altar.
And Ram lifted it, threw it in the air, caught it, strung it, pulled the string, and broke it.
Mithila is the place Ram and Sita were married.
Holy, holy place.
So many people, if you wanted to study Nyaya, you had to go to Mithila. And it was like a monopoly situation.
The scholars of Mithila, they had their book, and they would not give out copies of even a single page to anyone.
And it's a big book.
Sarva Bhoma Bhattacharya. He was one of the great scholars and professors of Navadvip.
He went to Mithila to study Nyaya.
Do you know what kind of scholar he was? He heard it from his teachers and memorized every word of it.
Came back to Navadvip and wrote down everything he memorized.
These are the kind of scholars we're talking about.
And then, because he was so brilliant, he expanded on it. He took this authorized Shastra of Nyaya and then wrote commentaries that gave such incredible depth that no man has ever seen. So from that point on, Navadvip was the unparalleled high seat of learning for the world. And literally, millions of students were coming here. They were coming from Varanasi. They were coming from Mithila to learn Nyaya. Because it was better here. Plus they could learn everything else. They were coming from South India, from Kanchipuram, from Srirangam. They were coming from Mathura. Everywhere. Yogis were coming from the Himalayas. If you got it, it explains that every day there were thousands and thousands of students who were leaving Navadvip with their diplomas to show everyone, I have graduated from Navadvip. You know, today if you graduate from Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or MIT, or I hate to say it, even IIT, that doesn't have even a fraction of the prestige as getting a diploma from any professor from Navadvip. But there was a problem. For it was all scripture that they were learning, but it was totally materialistic. It was knowledge for knowledge's sake. It was getting... I've said this many times before. Sports is always a very important part of life for most people. I spoke to somebody who was one of the reporters, editors of the New York Times. And he said, actually, most people who read, he gave me a percentage, but I just can't remember percentage, but it was a huge percentage. Most people, they look at the front page and then they go to the sport page. They just kind of skim through the front page and they carefully scrutinize the sport page. And we see, you know, I was in London during the Olympics this year. Can I just interrupt my flow by just telling you something I saw there? The world is so deceiving. Because before I went to London, I had all these programs and most of them were in the city. In America, people were warning me, don't go to London during the Olympics. There's going to be so much traffic. It's going to be so overcrowded. It's going to be impossible to get anywhere. Don't go. And there was all kinds of information being sent out by London. Unless you're coming to the Olympics, don't come to London because it's going to be so much congestion. But somehow the devotees in London set up these programs for me during that time. So I went, and I was expecting so much traffic and jams. One thing they told me is, on most all the big roads in the city, they made an entire lane only for the Olympic athletes and journalists. And unless you had a special Olympic authorized car, you couldn't go in that lane. And in England, the roads are kind of thin. So, you know, half the lanes are not there. So they were saying, so much traffic, it's going to be very difficult. So I was expecting that. I was thinking, it can't be any worse than Mumbai.
Oh,
What to think, what to speak of Kolkata.
So I arrive, and I'm staying downtown Mumbai, and we're going from the airport, and we're driving around, and there was nobody there. I go to London every year so many times. I never saw such little traffic. We were just going, and there was this lane that was reserved for the Olympic people. There were more people in that lane than all the other lanes. The taxi drivers were totally distressed because nobody wanted a taxi because there was no one around. And the shopkeepers were really in distress because they stocked up for all these people coming for the Olympics and nobody was around. What happened is the Olympics were on another end of London. So all the people who went to the Olympics, God knows how many there were, none of them came downtown because they were afraid it would be too congested. And from around the world, if you didn't go to that place, nobody went to London because they were afraid it was too congested. So this little Swami was just practically all alone. It's very nice, actually. But anyway, sports are very important. In India, I know a devotee. I'm not going to mention names because he might be somewhere among you. But when India lost a cricket match to Pakistan, he actually decided to commit suicide. It's before he was a devotee. And on his way to a bridge, somehow someone gave him Bhagavad Gita. And he was receptive. You know, it's one thing when you just, you know, you get a Bhagavad Gita and, oh, let me see what this is. And it's another thing when you're about to commit suicide because Pakistan just defeated India's cricket team. And in America, baseball, football, basketball, soccer, and other places, cricket, sports is a very, it's... If you put all these sports together and multiply by thousands, you don't get the popularity of scholarly debate. It didn't weep. That was the thing. When scholars were debating, everybody, oh, yeah, this is it. The whole society was at the edge of their seats. They all had their champions. But it was all mundane.
There was so much false ego. It was all just based on ego. Who knows more? Who could defeat somebody else? Who has more information? Even in the name of spirituality, it was all materialistic.
People
were spending massive sums of money for the weddings of their children to get the blessings for material prosperity and scholarship. People were worshiping snake goddesses to get material blessings. And this was basically what Navadvip was about.
And it was incredible. There was just a small group of devotees here, headed by Advaitacharya. Srivas was here. Murari Gupta was here. Srivas's brother, Haridas Thakur, was here. And these devotees, it broke their hearts. Nobody would chant the names of God. Nobody wanted to chant the names of Krishna. For them, at the best, God was just the order supplier.
He wasn't a person to surrender to. He wasn't a person to please.
Yesterday we were speaking a little of the Karma Mimamsa philosophy. Krishna told Nanda Maharaj that Indra, or even Ishvara, even God, this is the concept, they must give you what your karma deserves. So just do good karma and God will give you good material benefits. And even though the material world is a miserable place, if you have really good karma and you're really good, then you can enjoy this world to the topmost and God will supply it. And that's the perfection of life. There's nothing beyond. That's the best, the most deep spiritual concept that was here. For most, it was just, you know, conquering others, defeating others, fulfilling our envy, our arrogance.
And when the devotees saw this, they cried. Because the quality of a devotee is para dukkha dukkhi.
The suffering of another is my suffering.
The suffering
or the happiness of another is my happiness.
Because there's love. Just like a mother. I remember
I went to see my grandmother. She was very, very old. And she couldn't function so well. She was laying in a bed. And I hadn't seen her for a long time, and my father was there, and my father wanted to make sure she knew who I was. So he said, "This is Radhanath." I wasn't a Swami then. He said, "This is Radhanath." He said, "He's the Hare Krishna." And my grandmother looked at me and smiled. And she had tears in her eyes. And she said, "Hare Krishna." She said, "If it makes you happy, it makes me happy." So even in this world, the nature of love is the happiness of the people you love is more dear than your own happiness. And the suffering of a loved one is the worst thing that could happen to our heart. Devotees love the soul. Now, as we're listening to this narration, try to identify with it. How much am I really a devotee? How much do I really have this character of para dukkha dukkhi? A Vaishnava is one who is totally free of selfishness, who in their love for Krishna becomes such an instrument of Krishna's compassion in the world. We're trying to be Vaishnavas. On one level we are. But we shouldn't be proud about it. We should be humble by what it really means.
So the devotees, because of their ecstatic, intimate love for Krishna, they would chant Krishna's names, and as they would chant Krishna's name, they would feel the ecstasy of Krishna's love. But at the same time, they couldn't bear seeing their loving brothers and sisters in the form of all living beings deprived of it. Durlabha manava janma lobhya samsare. Thakur Bhaktivinod explained, this human life is so rare. When a devotee sees someone has attained this human life, the scripture tells there are 8,400,000 species of life. And generally the Atma, the living force, passes through the evolutionary cycle from one species to a next, from plants to fish to insects to reptiles to birds to animals. And there's so many thousands, sometimes millions of species within each of these species. Finally, the human birth. Durlabha manava janma. Durlabha manava janama satsangi. Taraha eva vasindare. This human life is so rare because in this human life, we can atato brahma jigyasa, we can question our existence. Who am I? Where am I coming from? Why is there suffering? What is the cause of suffering? What is the way out of suffering? Who is God? What is my relationship with God? What is the purpose of my life? Only a human being can ask these questions. So rare. To die as a human being without pursuing and receiving the true answers to these questions is such a loss. It's like you have the most precious jewel, but you just take it to be ordinary glass, and you spend your time just playing with other kinds of glass, never utilizing what you have. The devotees of Navadvip, they were not only weeping to see the suffering of people, they were weeping to see how they were so intoxicated sometimes with their happiness that they weren't ready to take what was really the source of happiness. And they were on the road to impending suffering. They were crying out to Krishna to help. And they would go out, and they were not judgmental, evangelist kind of people. They were humble devotees. They were approaching people either through philosophical debate or just through kindness and friendliness, just asking people, please, understand there's a purpose in life. Bhakti, love of God is within you. Take Krishna's names. And the people of Navadvip, the scholars, they hated the Vaishnavas. They criticized them, ridiculed them, persecuted them. Why? One is they had so much arrogance, they couldn't conceive of anybody with another conception than their own. And the devotees, they were giving up their egoism and selfishness for a higher principle. And if there is a higher principle than eagerness, than egoism and selfishness, then that makes them look really bad, because that was their goal in life, to fulfill that. These scholars of Navadvip, literally, this is what our scriptures biographers tell, they would persecute, criticize, threaten the devotees. They would write songs blaspheming the devotees and go into the streets and publicly sing them on a regular basis. Sri Chaitanya Bhagavat tells some of the songs even. I can teach you one if you like.
Something like that
a recluse ascetic who has surrendered his life to God, and a chaste lady who lives by very high cultural dignity, they will grow old and get diseased and die just like any other sinner. So what is the use of all your worship of God? Real success, real enlightenment. Enlightenment means when you are carried on a golden palanquin and you have hundreds of people in front of you playing instruments and chanting your glories. That is enlightenment. And these Vaishnavas, they're screaming Krishna's names. And they think that they're holy. They are lowly. How would you feel if somebody screams at you? Does that make you happy? I scream, Chakasha Nidai! That doesn't make him happy.
So they're saying they're screaming at God. You think that makes God happy? That makes God sick. Makes God disgusted. It disturbs God. It's blasphemy of God. This kirtan is nothing but blasphemy.
These people just... Srivas Thakur would have kirtans in his house. These people would say we should break down the house and throw it in the Ganges and throw Srivas and his brothers in it with it. These were the kinds of songs they were singing on the street
for the public to hear.
Can you imagine if they had internet?
And the devotees loved them unconditionally. They just wanted to help them.
The devotees could have just left that place and just been together and started some little ashram in some jungle and been happy. But how could they be happy when all these people were in such illusion?
Advaitacharya
was the most respectable person of the Brahmin community.
All the other devotees were always being blasphemed, persecuted, criticized, and everything else.
But Advaita, he was so learned. He was coming from such a high birth of Brahmins. He was literally the leader of the Brahmin community. He was so well respected. They didn't directly say anything against him like all the others. But he felt the pain more than anyone. Not the pain of what they were saying against him or the Vaishnavas, the pain of what they were doing to their own lives.
Advaitacharya saw that this is just the beginning of Kali Yuga. What's about to come? It pained his heart so deeply
that he made a vow. I have no power.
None of the other devotees have any power
to transform these people's consciousness.
I don't see anyone chanting the name of Hari at any time, except sometimes when they're taking their bath in the Ganga, they may say it as a ritual.
Advaitacharya made a vow that only if Krishna himself from the highest planet in the spiritual world, Goloka, descends, then he could give bhakti to these people.
He already had everything himself. His family had everything themselves.
He read in a scripture called the Gotamiya Tantra that anyone who offers tulsi leaves with manjaris, flowers, mixed with Ganga water, to the Shalagram Shila with love and devotion, Krishna will fulfill that person's desires. He was crying, offering tulsi leaves and Ganga Jal to his Shalagram Shila, weeping, begging Krishna to descend, to spread the glories of the holy names, to help these people. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, incessantly, he was offering these prayers.
Sometimes he was so emotional with compassion, he was roaring the names of Lord Hari.
That was nice. Do that again, please. Hari. He was roaring.
He was roaring the names of Krishna. And weeping.
He wasn't coughing.
His feeling, his emotion, his compassion was so deep that transcendental sound is not limited to time or geographical considerations. When with a sincere, earnest heart and a humble disposition, we cry out the name of Krishna, we should understand, whether it's kirtan or japa, when we chant the name of Krishna with a sincere and intent heart, that sound vibration covers the entire universe. That sound vibration reaches the spiritual sky. In 1967, Srila Prabhupada had just established our society, and he was very, very ill. And he told the devotees he was going to go to Vrindavan. From America. He said, if I must leave this world, I will leave in Vrindavan. And there's no better place for me to get good health than Vrindavan. My home. So they were all new devotees. The senior most devotees then were 2 years. What to speak of, most of the others were just a few months. And they had given up everything and given their hearts and their souls in love and surrender to Prabhupada. And now he was leaving and he may not come back. They were crying, weeping. And Srila Prabhupada looked at them with great gravity. He smiled. He said, if you are chanting Hare Krishna, and I am chanting Hare Krishna, we will always be together. There is no material limitation that can separate us. That's the nature of transcendental sound. And according to the purity of our heart, that's how much Krishna reciprocates by manifesting within the name when we chant. Krishna heard the calls of Advaita and decided to come. This was the situation. Haridas Thakur and Advaitacharya, they were chanting the holy names and doing puja day and night, crying for Krishna to come. Srivas Thakur was doing kirtan with his brothers and other devotees in his house, praying for Krishna to come. For us. Sachi Devi and Jagannath Mishra, they gave birth to 8 daughters. And each of those daughters died just after their birth. How tragic that is. For a mother to carry a child with such affection, with such motherly expectations in the womb for 9 months, and the father in such expectation of having a child 9 months, and then going through the process of birth, and then it dies. 8 consecutive children. They worshipped Ahokshajit, Vishnu, their family deity. You see, they're Nanda and Yashoda. Their desire to have a child was a pure offering of love to Krishna. To bring a child in this world to serve and love Krishna. That's an offering. Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, I am that sex life that is according to true religious principles. When Bhaktivinoda Thakur prayed for Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, for Krishna to send one of his own personal associates to help expand this movement, that's an act of deep love. Our acharyas and Srila Prabhupada teach this is the opportunity grihasthas have in having children. To do it as an offering of love. And there's a way of doing it that way. They're pure hearts. They worship the Lord because the Lord wanted to take birth as their son. And then they had a little baby boy, and his name was Vishwaroop, and he lived. And Srila Prabhupada explained, sometimes people worship God when there's a problem, but then when the problem's solved, and, okay, God, thank you. Now I have other things to do. But they increase their worship for God, their love and their devotion and their puja, because they were so grateful. And then it so happened. In the month of Magh, the year 1485, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who is going to come to taste the sweetness of Sri Radha's love and to spread that love to the world, that love, that Lord, entered first into the heart of Jagannath Mishra. And from the heart of Jagannath Mishra, he became totally ecstatic. The Lord was present in his heart physically. And then the Lord, by his own sweet will, transferred himself from the heart of Jagannath Mishra to the heart of Sachi Devi. And then he entered into her womb. It was nothing like what humans and other species do to have children. It was a pure divine arrangement of God's descent. When Sachi Devi became pregnant, she became effulgent with light. She was experiencing such deep happiness. Everything seemed to become totally auspicious around her. People would see her and just start offering, bowing down, and they didn't even know why. It was just natural. People were coming and giving gifts to them. Jagannath Mishra told Sachi Devi that I had this vision. I had this unbelievable vision. I had a vision where there was this light within my heart, and that light brilliantly and emanated from me and entered your heart. And Sachi Mata said, I had the same vision. Sachi Devi said, I'm seeing celestial beings coming and offering worship to the child within my womb. There was great anticipation. It was 9 months past. The child was still inside. 10 months past. The child was still inside. 13 months! Now, for you mothers, there's some anxiety there.
So Sachimata and Jagannath Mishra went to Nilambar
Chakravarti, who was the greatest astrologer of the time. And they asked, when is this child going to be born? And Nilambar Chakravarti did the horoscope
and came to the conclusion, he's waiting, he's a divine being who's waiting for the most auspicious possible moment to appear.
It was in the month of Falgun, the year of 1486 by our Western calendar. The sun set in the town of Nadia. Navadweep is nine islands. His Holiness Bhakti Purushottam Maharaj gave a brilliant class yesterday, where he was describing how Navadweep is like a lotus flower. And eight of the islands are like beautiful eight petals of a lotus. And Antardweep is like the whirl of the lotus. And in the center of Antardweep is Mayapur. And in the center of Mayapur is the Yogapeet, the house of Jagannath Mishra and Sachi Devi. As the sun was setting, the moon rose over Mother Ganga. And Kaviraj Goswami explains, when a moon full, he said, that when the pure, spotless moon of Gaurachandra is going to rise in Navadweep, what is the position of that moon full of spots? So considering this, there was an eclipse.
Now for some people, an eclipse is the most inauspicious time. And for other people, an eclipse is the most auspicious time.
Different philosophies about eclipses.
But it was a lunar eclipse.
The moon was completely covered by Rahu. At that time, it is the custom of everyone, in order to protect themselves from the inauspiciousness.
Because people who, all of these great scholars who are very, very egoistically, materialistically oriented, they're really into auspiciousness.
They all went to the Ganga, and they were loudly, at this time, there was no other alternative,
they were chanting the holy names of Krishna.
Such an emergency to get these people to chant. But they were all chanting. They were chanting constantly. They didn't want a moment to end without chanting, not a gap, because some inauspiciousness might creep in at that time. So they were just, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna.
When they were chanting, the devotees were so happy. It's the first time they ever heard any of the other people chanting.
Srivas Thakur began to dance and smile, and he turned to the other devotees and said, may this eclipse last forever.
And it was at that time
the smarta Brahmins were chanting. Their wives were chanting.
Even the people of the Islamic faith that were living here, seeing all the Hindus chanting, they got so caught up with it, they started chanting. Everyone was chanting. It was massive. Millions and millions and millions of people all around Navadweep. Vrindavan Das Thakur said,
In the bathing ghats at Navadvip, where the scholars would give their classes, each bathing ghat would have sometimes hundreds and thousands of people at a time.
This is the popularity of this place.
And everyone in all directions were crying out Krishna's name.
It was at that moment, as the moon was rising, the full moon, that Lord Gauranga appeared from the womb of Sachi Devi and manifested himself to this world. He was so beautiful. His complexion was luminous with a golden aura. His eyes, even though he was a small child, now, you know, Swamis have their perceptions of babies. I mean, you know, I've been to Bhaktivedanta Hospital and some devotee, their little baby's born, and they show him to me and say, isn't he beautiful? You know, this is like a material conception of prema and janachurita bhakti. The mother loves the child. You know, he looks kind of like a
raisin. You know,
all kind of shriveled up. And of course he's beautiful.
But you know, newborn babies are not, you know, objectively, they're not so beautiful.
Subjectively, that's a whole other thing. But Lord Gauranga, he was beautiful. Objectively, subjectively, and yet beautiful lotus-like eyes. It just, as soon as he was born, they opened. It just, and as he gazed at people, and he smiled. He didn't cry when he was born. He smiled. His face was like a beautiful golden moon with lips like red bimba fruits and a nose like a little sesame flower. And his hair was cascading around his hair. And every limb of his body was just the perfection of sweetness. Everyone just fell in love with him. At that time, Nilambar Chakravarti came to do a little horoscope, and another Brahmin came. Nilambar Chakravarti said, this child, he will nourish the entire world. Therefore, I give him the name Vishwambar. And this Brahmin said, according to my calculations, this child, he is as good as Lord Narayan. He has come as the most munificent, merciful of all beings to spread the highest and purest religion throughout the entire world. He will give the greatest bliss and happiness to anyone who comes in contact with him. And he was about to say something else, but he stopped. He was about to say, but when he's 24 years old, he's going to take sannyasa and leave home. But he decided, let's keep things happy.
When Jagannath Mishra was just a simple Brahmin. He didn't have much material possessions at all. When this Brahmin, he made these predictions. According to the horoscope and according to the holy books of who this child was, he wanted to give him so much in gratitude. But he had nothing. All he could do was fall at the feet of this Brahmin and weep tears on his feet.
and Nimai was born. He was born under a neem tree. You see, the neem tree has very bitter leaves. Sometimes people eat neem leaves so that mosquitoes don't bite them. Because if you eat enough neem leaves, your blood becomes bitter. And then mosquitoes don't like you. I tried it. I got malaria. So some people were saying, well, you don't want to get it again, so just eat these neem leaves. So I was eating neem leaves, and they're really bitter. And the mosquitoes were still biting me. As Kali Yuga continues, even mosquitoes lose their discrimination. But because the neem leaf is so bitter, it's like a symbolic traditional idea that any inauspicious being, ghostly beings or other unwanted supernatural astral forces, will not come near the neem tree. And because eight of their children already passed away, Sachimata gave birth to Nimai under a neem tree. And she gave him the name Nimai. And some of the neighboring ladies who were there, the relatives, they said, because he's as beautiful as Krishna, Lord Hari, with a golden complexion, we will call him Gaur Hari. And others, Jagannath Mishra and others, every limb is so beautiful, so attractive. It's melting our hearts with love. There's with that golden complexion, we will call him Gauranga. One who has golden limbs. He brought joy to everyone. But from his very birth, he revealed to the world what his mission would be. He would cry. And because everyone loved him more dear than they loved even their own lives, there was nothing more painful than seeing him cry. They would do everything, anything for him. They would hold him, they would play with him, they would give him, Sachimata would try to give him milk, and anyway. But nothing could stop his crying except not just one person, but the whole family and all the neighbors had to gather around Nimai, clap their hands, and chant the holy name. As soon as they chanted, Nimai smiled. What a smile. Even though he's just a newborn infant, still he has all the power, all the attractive of Krishna, Rasa Bihari, Gopinath, Madhava. His smile enchanted everyone's minds and hearts. He glanced upon them with that smiling faith, and it was like beams of bliss would fill them. And he saw how much happiness that gave them. You know what Nimai did? Any time there wasn't chanting in the house, he would cry.
And as soon as he cried, it broke everyone's heart so much, everyone came together, clapped their hands to chant the holy names. And when they stopped, he cried. Kirtaniya Sadahari. In the house of Nimai Pandit, there was constant chanting of the holy names of Krishna. And everyone was so totally united. This is bhakti. When we put Krishna in the center. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not just come to teach us kirtan. He taught us to prem sankirtan. The kirtan of ecstatic love. Where our hearts, when we come together in kirtan, this is our goal. Our hearts are totally united to give pleasure to Krishna. All of our egoistic, conditioned differences have no relevance. We have, may have different opinions, we may have different ideologies, we may have different natures, we may have, you know, accidentally stepped on each other's feet, whatever we may have done.
We may be black or white or red or yellow or male or female, we may be from India or Pakistan, America or Russia. We may be Brahmas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, Malechas, Yavanas. Lord Chaitanya taught, when we come together in kirtan, we are chanting to please Krishna.
And when we come with that motivation, we become loving brothers and sisters. Srila Prabhupada took the most profound siddhanta conclusions of the deepest philosophies and brought it in such a simple package. He said, just keep Krishna in the center. And you'll be happy and attain perfection. What does it mean to put Krishna in the center? That means to take oneself out of the center. The whole reason we're suffering birth after birth after birth in this material existence is we all want to be the controller, the proprietor, and the enjoyer. But how do we take ourselves out of the center? The ego is so conditioned, and it's so deep, and it's so gross, and it's so subtle.
Param Drishmani Vartate. It's possible when we experience something higher, and that's to put Krishna in the center.
Even in the name of religion, even in the name of bhakti, we have so many reasons to dislike each other, even to hate each other, to envy each other, to criticize each other.
That means we're putting ourselves in the center.
Lord Chaitanya taught this principle when he was an infant, to bring everyone together. They were chanting simply for the pleasure of Nimai. And he was reciprocating. By his smile and his glances, the love of his heart was showering upon them infinitely. And feeling his love, the love of their hearts were showering upon him infinitely. And the whole expression was their united sangam to give pleasure to Nimai by chanting his holy names.
Krishna, 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 Hare, 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 Hare.
This is the blessing of Navadvip Dham. We will continue tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Gauranga Mahaprabhu ki jai. Ananti Koti Vaishnav Vrinda ki jai. Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai. Gaur Premanandi.